This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. In your health today, we examine things that may or may not have a beneficial effect on your brain, from Mozart to coffee. We start by looking at whether a daily cup of coffee does more than just perk you up in the morning. New research on caffeine is hinting at all kinds of potential benefits, from cancer protection to staving off diabetes and brain diseases. NPR's Allison Aubrey looks at the science behind the claims about Alzheimer's prevention.
5 cups of coffee a day may sound like an excessive amount of caffeine. I can only imagine the jitters, the trips to the ladies' room. But for neuroscientist Gary Arendash, this is his normal consumption.
5 to 6 cups of coffee a day. Religiously. I truly do.
Why so much? Arendash is convinced that caffeine protects his brain. He and his colleagues at the Florida Alzheimer's Disease Research Center have been studying the effects of caffeine on the brains of mice with Alzheimer's disease, and they found that adding caffeinated water to the rodents' diets results in big improvements in the animals' performance on short-term memory and thinking tests. They've also documented that these mice on caffeine end up with about a 50% reduction in abnormal amyloid proteins, which are thought to play an important role in the development of Alzheimer's. Arendash says in these studies, the dose of caffeine is critical to the protective effect.
The human equivalent of 2 cups of coffee does not have benefits in our Alzheimer's mice. 5 does. So you can see that many of us are below that threshold level that confers what we believe is protective benefits.
So now we know why Arendash is committed to his 5 cups. But can we really translate studies in mice into reliable advice for humans? Not so easily, says researcher Joan Lindsay of the University of Ottawa. Animal research is tricky.
It's always a good starting point, but we never know how well it's going to hold up with humans.
Human physiology is a lot more complicated, and researchers have learned that mice can respond really differently than humans do to a drug, an environmental toxin, or a change in nutrition. And it takes some real efforts to do a reliable test of the memory of mice. Here's what Arendash has come up with. He puts mice in little swimming pools with lots of alleys and dead ends to see how quickly they can find and remember hidden escape platforms.
The first thing that is lost in Alzheimer's is short-term memory, the memory for what happened a few seconds, a few minutes ago. And that is what this task is focusing on.
Now, there may not be so much interest in Arendash's mice studies if scientists hadn't also begun to gather some evidence from observing coffee drinkers that a steady caffeine habit is beneficial to people, too. One recent study comes from the northern European country of Finland, where researchers followed about 1,400 coffee drinkers for more than 2 decades. Neurobiologist Huntington Potter of the University of South Florida explains the Finnish researchers found one group seemed to benefit the most, those who'd been drinking 3 to 5 cups of coffee a day throughout middle age.
They had about a 65% to 70% reduced risk of developing Alzheimer's disease in their 70s.
Potter says the effect held up even when researchers controlled for things such as cardiovascular disease, which can influence the risk of dementia. So in his estimation, it's a good study. But does it prove that lots of coffee drinking prevents Alzheimer's? Not by a long shot, says Harvard researcher Risa Sperling. Finnish coffee drinkers might have other habits in common that could explain the protective effect. Say, for example,
people who are very active in midlife are much more likely to be drinking coffee than couch potatoes. And so I would hesitate to say that that's, you know, epidemiologic evidence that coffee prevents Alzheimer's disease.
Sperling says Alzheimer's is an incredibly complicated disease. Exercise and good nutrition do seem to be protective, but one's risk is largely determined by genes. No one thing, even coffee drinking, can erase that risk. If future research brings stronger evidence that caffeine may modify the risk by some small percentage, coffee lovers will have one more reason to drink away. Just make sure those 5 cups don't keep you up all night, because sleep is important to your health, too. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Early last week, news outlets went into overdrive when they learned that Rolling Stone magazine was about to publish an explosive article about General Stanley McChrystal's exceedingly candid comments about the Obama administration's national security team. That story, of course, led to General McChrystal's resignation. However, for several hours, readers had a very hard time finding the actual article that sparked all the ruckus. Rolling Stone had yet to put the story online when the news broke, so at least two news organizations took it upon themselves to post a full PDF file of the piece called The Runaway General without Rolling Stone's permission. Was that a necessary act in the name of news gathering, or was it copyright infringement, plain and simple? For answers, we turn to Bill Gruskin. He's the Dean of Academic Affairs at Columbia Journalism School, and he's the former managing editor of The Wall Street Journal Online. Welcome to the program, Mr. Gruskin.
Hi, thank you.
Now, the republishing of the McChrystal article is a very high-profile example of something that seems to happen every day. Internet sites regularly aggregate or curate content that's been published by others. But in this case, the content had not been officially published yet. So did the sites that posted the PDF of that article, Time and Politico, those sites, did they cross a line by making it available?
I think they crossed the line in the same way that a bank robber who goes into a bank and takes money out of the cashier's drawer crosses a line.
Now, you know, there are some people who fall on a different side of the table in this debate. There are some that basically celebrate if someone picks up or, in this case, steals some of their content, if indeed they link back to them, because that's a way to drive traffic back to their site. If these two organizations had pulled the PDF and had provided some sort of link, would that have made this the kind of thing that would pass muster?
Yes, I think you're exactly on point there. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens a million times a day all over the web. And I would imagine, in retrospect, Rolling Stone might have wished that they had had an online version ready to go and already published at the time that they sent advanced versions of this out to the Associated Press, which is how the story first got out.
Mr. Gruskin, I'm going to take you out of the Ivy League and put you back in the newsroom. When you were running the Wall Street Journal online operation, how would you have handled this?
We dealt with this on a pretty regular basis. The Wall Street Journal,
but this is not a run-of-the-mill story here. I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're talking about a big, explosive story, one source not available to you. What would you have done?
Well, we used to have stories, and the Wall Street Journal still breaks stories along these lines. Big merger stories that would move the stock market by many points, one way or up or down. We developed over a few years a fairly calculated strategy about how we would go about putting this out there. Of course, the Wall Street Journal is a subscription site, but we would often put those stories on the free part of the site, and we would encourage a lot of traffic back to the Wall Street Journal. We would also get our PR department working to make sure it was disseminated widely to a lot of other media outlets, always ensuring that at the end of the day, people knew this was a story broken by the Wall Street Journal. What Rolling Stone has gotten out of this, and this is important to keep in mind, is a huge boost to their name, to their credibility, and it's put them on the map for many people who would think that this is simply a magazine that covers pop and rock music.
Bill Gruskin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Gruskin is the Dean of Academic Affairs at Columbia Journalism School. He's also the former managing editor of the Wall Street Journal Online. Karan Mahajan is the author of the novel Family Planning. Mahajan was born in the United States, but he grew up in New Delhi. That's also where his first novel takes place. Family Planning is a tragic comic story of a New Delhi politician who's become obsessed with having more and more children, even as his family and city collapses around him. In his own reading, Mahajan admits to enjoying the musings of a grunge rock star who is mostly worshipped by teenagers. Here's his essay for our series, My Guilty Pleasure, in which authors talk about a book they are embarrassed to love.
When you're done reading Every Last Thing by a famous writer, literary convention holds that you move on to his or her letters, the DVD extras peddled by publishers. I have friends who have read the letters of Philip Larkin, Sylvia Plath, Allen Ginsberg, John Cheever, you name it, I have very pretentious friends. So it always embarrasses me to admit that the only complete set of journals I own are those by Kurt Cobain, a rock star. Not just any old rock star, but one who used to cross-dress and rhymes the word mosquito with libido in his most famous song. But for the naysayers who think that the journals have little worth beyond being a pacifier for weepy fans who've been mourning Cobain since he killed himself at the age of 27, I'd like to say, you clearly don't know Cobain the writer. Cobain the writer is funny and self-aware and snotty with a knack for off-the-cuff profundity. Remarking to a friend that his band will be called Nirvana, he scribbles next to it the gleeful words, "Ooh, eerie, mystical doom." He also jokingly refers to himself as the moody bohemian member of the group, which is pretty much how most folks remember the man behind that amazing ulcerous voice. Better still, there's a trashy throwaway quality to the pages that makes them a lighter read than you'd expect, like you've accidentally Googled your way onto someone's blog. Page after page of Cobain's terrible handwriting is reproduced in faithful facsimile, covering such topics as forthcoming gigs, favorite songs, prophecies of fame, janitorial wages, and of course, the firing of terrible drummers, complete with gory sketches to drive home his point. What isn't present here, for better or for worse, are hyper-confessional entries that can be used to further dissect why Cobain took his own life. Even in ranting about drug abuse and the pressures of stardom, he comes across as a smirky young man who appreciates his luck and can see the comedy of having turned into a national icon. Novelists get to say plenty in their massive tomes. Rock singers? They only get 4-minute songs with 2 verses and a chorus worth of lyrics. And so there's a real pleasure in accessing the intelligence behind the music, even if it doesn't qualify as great literature. And hey, I'm not the only one who thinks that the journals are better than mere DVD extras. Just ask the poor publisher who had to pony up $4 million for a bunch of chicken scrawl.
Karan Mahajan is the author of the novel Family Planning. His pick for our book series, My Guilty Pleasure, where authors recommend a book they're embarrassed to love, is The Journals of Kurt Cobain. For more summer book stories, interviews, reviews, and commentary, or to comment on this essay, go to npr.org. This is NPR. In the Gulf of Mexico, Tropical Storm Alex is threatening to become a full-blown hurricane. It could threaten the coast of Texas or Mexico, but at this point it does not appear to be headed for the blown-out oil well off Louisiana. Even so, it's quite possible that the storm could spawn 10 to 12-foot waves, and those waves could sweep across the Gulf and complicate efforts to control the spewing oil. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Even though BP is collecting about 25,000 barrels of oil a day from the blown-out well, there's still plenty more oil surging into the sea. BP Vice President Kent Wells says this week the company was hoping to run a pipe from the well up to another ship in order to double the oil collection capacity.
Basically, we've got about 3 days of additional work to do. This is very, I'll call it kind of precise work. A lot of it's done on the surface, and we require flat sea states to do that work.
And unfortunately, the seas are not flat. There's a big storm, Alex, way off to the west. It doesn't seem to be threatening the worksite with wind and rain, but it is roiling the surface of the sea for hundreds of miles.
So it will create waves, and we expect over the next 6 or 7 days that the sea heights to go from the 3 to 4 feet, which they have been, up to perhaps 10, even 12 feet. And that will restrict our ability to do these operations.
Installing this new collection system could potentially be a big deal. If it operates near capacity, it could at long last reduce the torrent of oil to a much smaller trickle. But it's not looking hopeful for this week, as BP had hoped.
Depending upon weather, we could see a 6 to 7 day delay in bringing this next phase of our subsea containment online.
And if the waves are rough enough, crews could even have to stop collecting oil with the drill ship Enterprise, which right now is gathering more than half of the oil that's being salvaged from the damaged well. In a news conference conducted over a speakerphone, National Incident Commander Thad Allen said the storm system is already affecting the movement of oil across the surface of the Gulf.
It was generally heading east.
In fact, people were bracing for it along the panhandle of Florida, but now it's turned more to the north instead.
We now see oil start to enter Mississippi Sound and areas around Chandelier and Breton Sound. We're very concerned about that. We're moving forces there as we speak.
Oil skimmers will eventually have to head for safety if the seas get too rough, and at some point, nothing can protect the most vulnerable areas along the coast. If there's a full-blown storm surge with some future storm, that will push oil deep into the delicate marshes. Richard Harris, NPR News.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
An unusual public school in New York City is using a video game as its model for how to teach and for what kids should know. The school, called Quest to Learn, is wrapping up its first year. Heather Chaplin reports on how it has implemented the idea that playing and designing video games is part of 21st century literacy.
Video games don't come with instructions, but have you ever seen a kid not figure out how to play? Something about video games turns kids into phenomenal learners. Katie Salen wanted to harness this power.
The big idea of the school is that we looked at how games work, literally how they're built, and the way they support learning. And we thought, could we design a school from the ground up that supported learning in the way that games do?
This idea has been advocated for years by scholar James Gee, one of Salen's mentors. They believe video games are key to a new kind of literacy for the 21st century.
In math, we're traveling around the world.
That's sixth grader Rocco Rose, a student at Quest to Learn and a citizen of Creepy Town, an imaginary city where his class learns math and English. Right now, they're travel agents, converting currencies, keeping blogs about their travel experiences, and budgeting trips.
So you wouldn't be able to go to Tokyo, you wouldn't be able to go to Athens without actually opening up that vault.
Creepy Town is structured like a video game that's jumped out of the computer. Katie Salen explains the kids have 10-week missions culminating in a boss level.
The second trimester, Creepy Town went broke. They had like an economic crisis, and so the kids looked at all their receipts to figure out, well, what went wrong, and then they proposed the design of a theme park to bring revenue in, so they designed a theme
park. Creepy Town, like a video game, is a complex dynamic system, a model that changes depending on what the player does. Salen says playing with complex dynamic systems gives kids opportunities to learn.
To learn how to solve problems, how to communicate, how to use data, how to begin to predict things that might be coming down the line.
They also learn something called systems thinking, which Salen says is one of the cornerstones of 21st century literacy. It helps you understand how, say, the behavior of a derivatives trader in Hong Kong affects housing prices in Florida. When a system becomes sufficiently complex, Salen says, you start to get outcomes that are hard to foresee.
Suddenly you begin to get what's called emergent behavior. In an emergent behavior, that system, the elements in it begin to relate to each other in ways that can be unpredictable.
In a classroom across the hall from Creepy Town, 12-year-old Liam Smith is working with his team to storyboard one of Aesop's fables. It's the first step of the game design process. At Quest to Learn, students not only play in game-like environments, they also make video games. Salen says there's no better way to learn systems thinking than making one. It's also familiar, says Liam.
When you start playing games at age 3, I think it just comes naturally to you.
For parents, though, video games aren't necessarily so familiar. Sam Clayton said choosing to send his child to Quest to Learn was a difficult decision.
Getting involved with the school, since there has been no program previously existing quite like this, that it was a complete leap of faith getting involved and like jumping off a bridge.
Kids at Quest to Learn do take the same standardized tests as all public school kids. Valerie Shute has a grant to assess the school from the MacArthur Foundation, which put up the seed money for Quest to Learn.
The school's under a huge microscope right now, and there's a lot of people that are hoping for, you know, a wild success and other people hoping for the opposite.
Shute says she's optimistic traditional skills like math won't take a beating. For Katie Salen, the bottom line of 21st century literacy is empowerment.
What systems thinking does is it simply gives you a tool to manage complexity. Because of the complexity of problems, if you're not able to look at them as a system, you're just going to look at a blur. You will just be overwhelmed by the complexity.
The school has around 500 applicants for 85 slots in next year's class, so Creepy Town will be thriving for at least one more year. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today, the White House threw its support behind part of the Federal Communications Commission's ambitious National Broadband Plan. President Obama signed a presidential memorandum that commits the government to increasing the amount of wireless spectrum. The goal is to improve Americans' access to high-speed internet. Today's announcement follows closed-door meetings the FCC held last week with the biggest broadband companies. The firms are opposed to the commission's plan to regulate broadband internet access. Public interest advocates have rallied behind the FCC. And as Joel Rose reports, both groups claim the facts are on their side.
Internet companies and their backers like to say the free market is doing fine on its own. Here's Texas Representative Joe Barton at a congressional hearing in March.
95% of America has broadband.
Well, yes and no. 95% of Americans do have access to broadband where they live. But when it comes to adoption, actually signing up for broadband at home, the number is much lower, around 63%.
The numbers don't lie. For the providers to try to say that there's no problem, it's merely just a smokescreen.
Derek Turner is research director for the public interest group Free Press. When it comes to broadband adoption, Turner says the U.S. has fallen behind other developed countries, including such technological powerhouses as Estonia.
Depending on whose numbers you look at, we're definitely a middle-of-the-pack performer, but even more alarming is the direction we're heading. We're trending downward. We're dropping in the rankings. Countries are bypassing us.
The two narratives about how easy and cheap it is to get online in the U.S. are so starkly different that it's hard to believe both sides are talking about the same internet. But they are, says John Horrigan. He studied broadband adoption for years, first at the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and now at the FCC.
There are a lot of different measures that float around, and so people might pick a number that makes their case and not look at numbers that might suggest a somewhat different story.
Broadband presents one of the great glass-half-empty, glass-half-full stories.
Bruce Melman is co-chair of the Internet Innovation Alliance, an industry-supported group that opposes more regulation. He thinks broadband adoption in the U.S. is going well, considering broadband's only been available for 10 years.
Within a decade, we've seen faster broadband deployment than you saw for cell phones, than for cable TV. It's one of the great technology success stories in history.
Great for business, but maybe not so great for consumers.
The broadband marketplace in America suffers from really two critical failures: high prices and low speeds.
Joel Kelsey is an analyst at the nonprofit Consumers Union, publisher of Consumer Reports. He says 96% of Americans can only get broadband from two or fewer companies. That's good for those phone and cable companies and their shareholders. But Kelsey says it's bad public policy.
If you talk to industry, they look at it and think of broadband as a private commercial service, akin to pay television or cable TV. And if you look at how the internet has developed, a lot of folks out there believe it is an essential input into this nation's economy. It is an essential infrastructure question.
In the last 10 years, broadband has become a crucial part of how we communicate, shop, work, and even apply for jobs. And therefore, Kelsey says it should be regulated like other technologies we consider essential, including electricity and telephone service. But Bruce Melman at the Internet Innovation Alliance thinks we don't need more government intervention to make broadband faster and cheaper.
Well, we haven't yet, and that's in the first decade. And in the second decade, the marketplace is only going to be that much more competitive.
FCC officials don't seem so sure. They say some basic regulations are necessary to protect consumers and spur competition. But the big internet companies are pushing back with more numbers of their own, lobbying dollars. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.